Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Papal Audience. Pope Benedict continues his catechesis on Christian prayer by looking at the biblical account of Jacob's struggle with God, which is seen as a symbol of prayer as a faith-filled struggle. The Suffering Church. Pope Benedict called for a World Day of Prayer for the Church in China this week, and we shine the spotlight on the persecution and pressures endured by Chinese Catholics. Saving from slavery. We learn how the Catholic bishops and police in the UK are forming a partnership to fight against human trafficking, the fastest growing form of slavery today. Out of control. That's how one American bishop describes the growing epidemic of pornography, especially online porn, that is sweeping through today's society. And green thought for today. We continue our series of reflections on God's creation and Pope Benedict's teaching on the environment with this contribution by a professor in Catholic theology at the University of Bristol. At his Wednesday General Audience, Pope Benedict continued his catechesis on Christian prayer by looking at the biblical account of the patriarch Jacob's struggle with God at the ford of the Jabbok. The Pope says this story is seen as a symbol of prayer as a faith-filled struggle which demands our unremitting effort, yet ends by surrender to God's mercy. Emma McCarthy tells us more.
Continuing his series of lessons on Christian prayer this Wednesday, Pope Benedict XVI spoke of our struggle to surrender to God in prayer. Drawing from the passage in Genesis that recounts Jacob's battle with the unknown at the Jabbok Forge, the Pope said, "Our whole life is like this long night of struggle and prayer, to be consumed with the desire and search for God's blessing, that cannot be torn or won by counting on our own strength, but must be received from him with humility, as a free gift that finally allows us to recognize the face of the Lord."
The mysterious encounter takes place at night, when Jacob is alone and unarmed. The identity of his assailant and the winner of the contest is not at first clear. Jacob is wounded and must reveal his name to his rival, suggesting his defeat. Yet he receives a new name, Israel, and is given a blessing. At daybreak, Jacob recognizes that his opponent is God. Limping from his wound, he now crosses the ford.
The Church's spiritual tradition has seen in this story, said Pope Benedict, a symbol of prayer as a faith-filled struggle which takes place at times in darkness, calls for perseverance, and is crowned by interior renewal and God's blessing. This struggle, he continued, demands our unremitting effort, yet ends by surrender to God's mercy and gift.
At daybreak, Jacob calls the place of his struggle Peniel, which means face of God. For he said, "I have seen God face to face, and yet my life is preserved." In our prayers, let us ask the Lord to help us as we fight the good fight of faith, and to bless us as we long to see his face.
Pope Benedict concluded the audience greeting the thousands of pilgrims and visitors present in various languages, including English.
Especially those from England, Ireland, Denmark, Norway, Nigeria, Australia, India, Indonesia.
In which he had a very special greeting for soldiers from the United States of America who had been wounded in the line of duty.
American soldiers, members of the Wounded Warriors Group.
In a special way, I welcome the group of Wounded Warriors with the promise of my solidarity in prayer. Upon all of you invokes the joy and peace of the risen Lord.
I'm Emer McCarthy.
Pope Benedict urged Catholics this week to join him in praying for the Church in China, saying the Chinese faithful want unity with the universal Church, with the supreme pastor, with the successor of Peter. The day of prayer took place on May the 24th, the feast day of Our Lady of Shishan, who is venerated at the shrine dedicated to her in Shanghai. China has an estimated 8 to 12 million Catholics. However, they are divided between the state-sanctioned Patriotic Association and the underground church faithful to Rome. In appealing for the day of prayer, Pope Benedict said he hoped the Chinese bishops' desire to remain loyal to the universal church will prove stronger than any temptation to follow a path independent of Peter. Father Bernardo Chavalera is the director of the Asia News Service and a leading expert on the situation facing the Catholic Church in China. He says the Pope's appeal for the day of prayer for the church in China helps to inform and remind people around the world about the suffering church there.
He stressed the fact that not only the Catholics outside China, but also the Catholics in China, they should pray more for the unity of the church. This is very, very important. And this is the only weapon in some way that the Pope and the church has. But I would stress that we Catholics outside China, we should pray much more for the church in China, because sometimes we don't understand or we don't know about the persecution they are suffering.
That was Father Bernardo Chavalera, expert on China and director of the Asia News Service. Human trafficking is the fastest growing form of slavery today, with millions of victims around the world. Although prohibited by international law, as well as under the criminal law of most countries, hundreds of thousands of women, children and men fall into the hands of unscrupulous human traffickers each year. Around 80% of these trafficked victims end up in the sex industry. In our programme last week, we heard how participants at a global conference in Rome called for the forging of effective public-private partnerships to fight the scourge of human trafficking. And this week, I wish to shine the spotlight on one of those partnerships that has been forged in the UK for this very purpose. The new partnership in question is between the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales and the Metropolitan Police Service of London. Detective Inspector Keith Hyland is a committed Catholic who heads the Anti-Trafficking and Prostitution Unit at the New Scotland Yard Police Headquarters. He has approached the Catholic bishops to ask for their help with raising public awareness about human trafficking and the fact that in the UK many of the victims of this crime are Catholics that come from countries like Poland, Lithuania or Nigeria. He began by telling me how many of these victims lose their freedom and basic human rights after being tricked by the traffickers.
Very often they are duped into thinking they're coming to London for working in, you know, in great industries, and the streets are paved with gold. However, sometimes it's just a case that they know they're coming in to work in something like prostitution, but don't realise the abuse or the exploitation they're going to suffer. And certainly those that are brought over for forced labour very often come here on the promise of great jobs that are open in London and within the UK, and end up working extremely long hours and being abused and subject to violence very often.
Now, you talked about the violence and abuse. I mean, just how brutally are they being treated by their pimps or gang masters? Can you give us some examples?
Yes, I know of cases where people have been held at gunpoint, where people have been severely injured, where people have been routinely beaten, where victims have been raped on a daily basis. So some of it is extremely distressing, and on other occasions where they might be locked up. But there are victims who do have a degree of freedom, but their whole human status is gone, in as much as at every right they've got, their passports are taken, they're told where to be. So on the surface, they may look like they're free to roam around and do as they like, but actually that isn't the true case.
Now, you say that most of these victims are women, but what percentage are minors under the age of 18? Just how young are some of them, in fact?
Well, unfortunately, we've seen victims as young as 7 years of age who have been used as in forced labour situations. So some of them albeit very rare, are extremely young. With the children, there are robust procedures in the UK to deal with those, but clearly the traffickers and those controlling the children will keep them very much in secret, so it's very difficult to estimate the amounts that are there.
What about the scale of the problem? Is it increasing?
I don't think there's been an increase. What I think there has been is we're better at identifying it, we're better at responding to it. In London, we have got a dedicated team who actually just investigate trafficking, and it's a significant team. So we have got better at identifying it and looking for it. And I think by working in partnership with groups such as the Catholic Church, we are going to actually increase the numbers who are able to step out of the environment of being trafficked and slavery. So I think it's the way we're operating and the partnerships that are actually allowing people to come out of it.
You yourself obviously are very aware of it and, other bodies. But what about the public at large? How much public awareness is there?
There are a number of things that we're doing. We work with a number of groups, charities and faith-based groups, and particularly now with the Catholic Church to raise awareness of this is a real situation. Clearly, the communities are our eyes and ears and can actually tell us when things are going on. But they have to be firstly made aware that this is actually happening and the things that they see could amount to trafficking. For example, even in rural parts of the UK, they may say a vehicle that takes people to work that is a poorly maintained vehicle, has a lot of people in it, goes to work really early, comes home very late, the people live in substandard accommodation. That could be an indication of trafficking or exploitation or modern day slavery.
And what kind of greater role in this whole area are you looking for the Catholic Church to play? Because you've been in touch with them, I know, about this matter.
Yes, I think this new partnership we've got with the Bishops' Conference is very exciting. I think that the aims of it and what we aim to achieve will be very significant. In the UK, I'm working with the Bishops' Conference and they're looking at preparing a strategy that will deal with the response and support that can be given towards trafficked victims and also the education that can be given to congregations. And that strategy is not just dealing with the UK element of that, it's about contacting other Bishops' Conference elsewhere in the world so that we can actually deal with this as a global issue through education, importantly prevention, so that people know that, be aware that this is happening. And of course, very often these people will come from regions where corruption is rife and they've got mistrust of police and authorities. So if they are trafficked or exploited and end up in the UK, it's important that they know that perhaps the first person they can go to is a priest or a local congregation.
How many traffickers on average are being caught and convicted for these crimes each year in the UK? Do we believe it's only the tip of the iceberg? What are the numbers?
Well, the unit that I head up has only been in existence for 12 months in its current form. So in the last 12 months, we have convicted 12 traffickers who have been involved in organised criminal networks of trafficking. We have got 22 cases or 22 individuals who are charged with trafficking, which involve 12 different organised criminal networks that are in the judicial process. We're investigating 22 cases of trafficking and we've got in the region of around 10 what we call proactive investigations, which are where we put significant resources in. We're also working in a number of countries, a number of Eastern European countries. I've got officers in those countries currently, and we're looking at when we do these investigations, we don't just deal with the UK element of it. We actually look at providing support to the country where the victims come from. We look at mounting prosecutions in those countries and identify charities and NGOs who can provide support for victims who may return there.
Could you briefly share with us an anecdote or even two that illustrate very clearly for us the ordeal, the plight of these victims of human trafficking and what they have to undergo?
Sure. I mean, a case that I can give you is actually involves a young Lithuanian woman who was trafficked from the Kaunas region of Lithuania. She was duped into believing that she was coming to the UK to spend a weekend with her boyfriend. When she arrived in the UK, he actually passed her on to another group of men who then took her up to the north of England and she was forced to work in brothels. After they had exploited her for long enough and in their view, she was of no more value to them, they brought her down to London where they sold her for £3,000. £1,000. She then eventually managed to escape, and it was her mother who brought it to the attention of us. We then mounted an investigation and identified this group and saw that they were trafficking more women. Now, in the time that she was forced to work with them, she would have to have sex with in the region of 20 men a day for little or no money. She was violently assaulted if she didn't do as they were told, and was actually treated worse than an animal. Now, that group did receive 18 years imprisonment when we identified them. We identified that they had victims all over the home counties and London, and that they had actually received some large sums of money that they were transferring back to their home country. So that's an example of a sexual exploitation. Another case of forced labour that I can give is where a man who came from Mauritius was brought to the UK via Ireland, and when he was brought into the UK was forced to work for a gang in criminal enterprise. Now, if he didn't do as they told him, he was subject to violence, was beaten and threatened. And very often these gangs will also make threats that they will actually go back to the home countries and dish out punishment to the families as well.
These victims must be severely traumatised after these ordeals, aren't they?
Absolutely. And that's one of the challenges we have. I mean, some cases that we deal with, the victims will not, quite understandably, trust the authorities, least of all the police. So we have to work very carefully with them. And that's where the charities and the church can assist us to broker the trust and to make sure that people realise that we are different to perhaps the countries they've come from.
I was speaking to Keith Hyland, head of the Anti-Trafficking and Prostitution Unit at the New Scotland Yard Police Headquarters.
We're changing day to day. Tell me,
pornography is a multi-billion dollar industry and has become ubiquitous in our modern society, especially on the internet, where millions of pornographic web pages can be found. As a case in point, experts say sex is the number one topic searched on the internet. A recent survey in the US showed that 70% of young men visit pornographic sites in a typical month, whilst one out of every six women grapples with addiction to pornography. And even most children in the West are being exposed to pornographic material. A survey in the US showed that 90% of children using the internet have viewed pornography online, mostly while doing their homework. One American bishop is so worried about what he calls this epidemic of pornography that he published a pastoral letter to warn Catholics in his diocese about its dangers and suggests ways to combat it within the family.
I believe that the pornography problem is out of control, that it is already affecting such a large percentage of people that it's already doing serious damage. And it's very difficult to get back into the box. I think it's almost impossible to cut off the sources of pornography. And so the most important efforts that we make, even though we will try to do some of those things, the most important efforts that we make will be in terms of strengthening people, seeking to fortify them in the exercise of the virtues, the re-establishment of chastity and purity.
Do you think in some ways it can be called a real addiction? It can be compared in some ways to, say, an addiction to gambling or drugs or alcohol?
I think that it is an addiction. I'm not a medical doctor or a psychologist by trade. I have heard one such medical doctor and a psychiatrist suggest that 10 hours of exposure to pornography can produce a chemical change in the brain, which is equivalent to an addiction to cocaine. I don't know if this is exactly true, but my impression is that there are emotional elements to it in terms of the addiction, but also there are apparently physical elements that cause this addiction and make it very difficult for a person to be released from it.
Is it particularly the young that become addicted to pornography? I saw that according to a survey, 90% of 8 to 16-year-olds using the internet have viewed porn online. I mean, that's quite a shocking statistic, isn't it?
It is very shocking. I don't know that the young people are more susceptible to it, although there may be issues of their own maturity and that early exposure to it may have more serious ramifications for a long life of exposure. Certainly, our young people are much more savvy. They're much more knowledgeable about getting on the Internet. They've grown up with it. Perhaps some of our older generations may be a tiny bit less susceptible to pornography because of their less interest in using the computer. But pornography is available, as always, in other ways.
Presumably, part of the reason why pornography has spread and become such an epidemic is due to the advent of the Internet. But presumably, it's also perhaps because partly it's lost its taboo that it once had. It's become more socially acceptable. We see things up on advertising billboards that at one time would have been considered pornographic.
I believe that this separation between sexual intimacy and responsibility was given a major negative impetus in the development of the birth control pill and the contraceptive mentality that I think we rightly speak of, a contraceptive mentality that separates human and sexual intimacy from sense of responsibility. Culturally, that separation, I think, has helped to remove the taboo. As you say, it has caused people to be much more lax about the variety of special intimate relationships, and we see the decline in terms of the media, as you said, and advertising, and that it just keeps getting more outrageous. And it is, seems to be of the nature of these things that more is needed in order to shock.
I was talking there to Bishop Robert Finn of Kansas City, St. Joseph. We now continue our series of reflections on God's creation and the environment with this contribution by Gavin da Costa, a professor in Catholic theology at the University of Bristol in Western England, referring to Pope Benedict's remarks on how environmental degradation is often the result of myopic economic interests. Da Costa says the Pope's words help us to understand our vocation as human beings and realize that every economic decision has a moral consequence.
A friend of mine complained that every time he heard about environmental issues, people ended up being gloomy and critical of everyone else. So today I want to start from somewhere different and try and avoid the gloom. I'd like to start with how wonderful and amazing is creation. The Bible starts with the same jaw-dropping awe at the beauty of creation. If you read Genesis 1, after every day of creating, we are told that God saw it was good. And on the day after creating us, the human person, God saw it was very good. That could have been a joke or a mistake, but let's hope it was not. We are part of creation. We are very good. And here's a story that brought this home for me. I was present at the birth of both my children, Sachin, my son, and Roshan, my daughter. It was literally a life-changing experience. For one thing, my wife was in considerable pain during the first birth, and to see someone you love cry out for quite so long as she did was just terrifying. It made me realize how little control over nature I have. But then to see a tiny, shiny head emerge and to hold this precious boy wrapped in swaddling clothes was one of the greatest joys of my life. My daughter was born in water, and my wife's experience was much calmer and with no less joy. I realized in both cases from that day on, I had to really live for someone else. I should add that being a selfish person, I'm not too good at this. And then I began to understand Pope Benedict's words in his World Peace message. He said, "Seeing creation as God's gift to humanity helps us understand our vocation and worth as human beings. contemplating the beauty of creation inspires us to recognise the love of the Creator, that love which moves the sun and the other stars. Well, my children are natural gifts, but they do bring on a certain dark shadow when I seek to protect, nurture, and keep them intact to help them flourish. How so? Well, bringing up children is fraught as well as thrilling and eye-opening. There is the whole commercial world which tells you that happy children need this game, those shoes, this particular holiday, and these special opportunities. There are siren sounds insisting that if we really want the best for our children, we have to spend, acquire, and consume with them, or else they and we will be unhappy. Well, of course, there is a grain of truth here, but the most important action towards our kids does not cost us a penny. It costs us a lot more. Time and attention. In my case, it costs putting them before a ferocious ambition in my professional life. It costs putting them before having a good time socially. And sadly, the list could go on and on. But I have a faint hope that when they look back over their lives, the imperfect love they have received will be that which they most remember, more than the bike, more than the holidays. I know that their love is the greatest gift I have received from them. It is a gift that heals and nourishes me more than I can say. Now, while nature does not show love to me, it heals, nourishes, and sustains me. I can see why people call her Mother Nature. Now, at this point, you will probably say, "Your children are not your environment." Well, I'm not so sure. Listen to Pope Benedict's words from the same speech. He says, "It is not hard to see that environmental degradation is often due to the lack of far-sighted official policies or to the pursuit of myopic economic interests, which then tragically become a serious threat to creation. To combat this phenomenon, economic activity needs to consider the fact that every economic decision has a moral consequence, and thus show increased respect for the environment." So, increased respect for our children, like our environment, trying not to use them for our own ends, is the beginning of a flourishing that is not within our control. But more often than not, it is also a source of delight that really makes life worth living. I really do think this is true of creation, and I know it's true about my children. At least so far. So here's a green thought to finish with. Loving God trains us to think about others and their needs. Let us think today about how we might help the green space that someone else needs, our children and their children, and all children. We might even join in that Genesis chorus, "And God saw it was good," and we might even add, "It was very good."
That reflection came from Gavin da Costa, a professor in Catholic theology at Bristol University. That's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.